Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. The final part of our panel discussion on elections will begin in a moment, with moderator Andy Downs asking about campaign finance reform. Michael Wolff, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Purdue Fort Wayne, will be the first to answer. Enjoy the show.
Obviously, we've had a couple people bring up campaign finance issues here, either the amount of money that has to be raised or the influence of it. Mike, what are the sort of institutional changes might take place that would make it a little more viable for a third party to get elected, even to a city council, let alone to the U.S. House of Representatives?
Campaign finance is a hard thing to change now because of the Supreme Court decisions. So it would be hard to imagine. Self-financing obviously helps. Donald Trump is kind of the example where you can get around some of the more formalized components of it. And that's not always favorable to everybody. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the power of ideas break through. Sometimes, it's just, we see a politician who wasn't a member of the two major parties in France, for instance, break through and become president when the two existing parties were kind of so negatively seen, right? So, you can never kind of give up on a potentially pregnant moment for a breakthrough, you know.
And as Cheyenne pointed out, and Julie as well, the polarization of what's happening right now, there are a lot of people who think that the parties are not particularly effective in this moment, which suggests, oh, maybe this is the time that third party is going to break through. But the reality is the rules are such that it's a little difficult to get traction. Julie mentioned needing 500 signatures to be as one of the steps to being a viable candidate for president in France. In Indiana, to be a candidate for governor, you need three or four times that, and that's just to be a third party, non-major party candidate. So we have barriers here that are going to keep this from happening, I think, anytime too quickly. Would a proportional system work a little bit better, perhaps, Mike? A proportional representation system?
I mean, we've talked about this considerably, and the benefits of that would be the potential introduction of another party. The downside is, though, is the notion of what we talked about with stability. You know, that when you open and change the system, especially with the institutions we have, you might not end up with the coalition or something that you would need to really provide. And our system is somewhat unstable anyway with the checks and balances. So the real question is, would that provide a legitimate alternative in our institutional system?
Yeah, the minority coalitions, when you have to get together those two or three groups to create a government, that does become kind of shaky because you've compromised on something at that moment. And that may be sort of the big concern. Cheyenne, what do you think?
I think it would work. I think part of the challenge would be figuring out what a strong, viable third party would actually stand for. There is a study that one of my colleagues here, Lee Drutman, put out recently on whether or not Americans want a third party. And two-thirds of Americans do seem to say, yes, a third party is a great idea. But they don't quite know what that third party would be. And I think that because of that, you open up, like Professor Wolff mentioned, the possibility for, you know, a lot of instability. When you open up for more parties, you're open up the risk for more extreme parties, more extreme candidates who could potentially end up in office. So that's dangerous. But it would also increase the number of ethnic minorities that are represented. It could potentially decrease the incentives for gerrymandering, right? Because then you could hopefully feel that, you know, the candidate that you're voting for is more representative of your community. So it's a trade-off.
Well, Mike, you've done some research on political discussion. It's always interesting when Mike's doing the research, especially if he has recordings of the respondents to his polls, because the responses are interesting, to say the least. Does the negative tone of what we're seeing right now energize particular voters, or is it really just turning everyone off?
No, it does energize some people. It energizes hardcore partisans. And for some of the reasons we've been talking about, what we're seeing in a lot of democracies is mobilization by negative tones. And in the American system, we look over 40 years, and even the strongest partisans like their party less than they did 40 years ago. So they aren't getting as mobilized by, you know, true love of their party and the party's positions. They are more and more mobilized by their hatred of the other party. And so that means that some of the negativity, some of the, you know, really tough stuff does mobilize some people. Now, it demobilizes others, so it's not a simple on-off switch. It does both. And so it's not a surprise that you kind of have this strange effect where some moderates in the middle and others are kind of turned off by the tone, but that really gets people jacked up to go out to vote that are strong partisans. And we have more of them. You know, this is the irony of it, is that with more education and with more media, we've given people a lot of good reasons to vote against somebody and the kind of cognitive power to do that. So as a result, you know, the unintended consequence is that negativity is on the rise.
And there's kind of a reality for political campaigns that if you know you can win the election with a small electorate, you're not encouraged to expand the electorate. So if negative tones turn off some voters but energize yours, in some respects, you're almost encouraged to do it from a practical standpoint.
Yeah, and we know this because no one knows how to approach the millennials and ask them to vote, and so they get ignored. And we go out and continue to knock on doors and knock around the other side, you know, as a way to win elections.
Mm-hmm. Julie, did you see much of this in France? Did you see that? Did you sense, read, feel that negative tone that some people say is happening here?
I did not. Mm-hmm. It was pretty much intellectual. The negative tone came in one debate, perhaps, when Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen were facing off. And in this particular debate, they were sitting across from one another at a desk with a moderator, but they had 20 or 30 minutes to say whatever they had to say. It was sort of like
the Lincoln-Douglas
debates. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like that, only sitting across. It was very funny. And Marine Le Pen was trying really hard to insult Emmanuel Macron, and he was like Teflon at that time. Now what's happening, from the little I'm following of French journalism right now, is Macron is no longer popular. And he was a golden boy for a couple, 18 months. And now he's no longer popular. So we're starting to see negative things come up that almost seem American-style negative from when I look at them. And that, I think, is political tone is being taken in the context of what happened in the American election. Mm. May I say that? I mean, it's just there was a context when I went over there.
Sure.
There was Brexit.
Yep.
There was then Donald Trump being elected. Mm-hmm. In that context, France sits in that crucible.
And there were other elections going on in Europe where similar dynamics were sort of playing out as well. Mm-hmm. Cheyenne, how about down in Brazil? Do you get the sort of negativity that we see here?
Yes, definitely. These are very challenging times back home. I think that I have certainly not experienced this kind of political moment in my lifetime before. And, you know, you have a country that went through probably one of the world's largest political scandals. It put nearly the entire political class in jail. We had one of the worst recessions in the last 30 years. And yeah, of course, you have this movement, this populist movement around the world that definitely fueled a lot of the rhetoric in Brazil. So we're definitely seeing that, particularly with Jair Bolsonaro, who's the front runner in the presidential election. His speech was very vicious. He was very aggressive. And as he became more popular, I think he got some very good political consultants to tell him to tone it down. So it's gotten a little bit better. And, you know, now he's appealing to more people. But definitely there's a lot of anger, a lot of disappointment in Brazilians in seeing their country go from, you know, being this South American giant with a lot of potential and just see being gutted by the political class. So this sort of anti-establishment movement, this populist wave that is saying what we need is order, what we need is, you know, to put bandits in jail, what we need is to, you know, give citizens guns so they can defend themselves. That is a very violent oriented kind of rhetoric, but because of the particular political environment, that's a rhetoric that's catching on, definitely.
I think it was last week, or even 2 weeks ago, I was listening to a news report about debates in Quebec, and the moderator was actually being criticized for holding the candidates in check, which I found an interesting approach, because here, you know, when we don't hold them in check is when we criticize. What is debate like? You mentioned 20 to 30 minutes, and I'm guessing during that time period it was okay to poke each other,
they
even though it wasn't
each other,
your turn.
Spoke. Yeah. They spoke from their prepared. There would be a sentence or a question would be asked, and then one would respond 10 or 15 minutes and back and forth, and they just talked. And the moderator sat there. And it was nice because you could really hear them talk. You could see their personalities. And Marine Le Pen had a very close chance of winning the election. Mm-hmm. And I think my husband and I are of the opinion that it was that vituperative attitude that she put forward, as well as she had notes all across her desk, and she was kind of trying to find her place, and Macron had nothing. He was just there and was able to speak extemporaneously, which is how French politicians are trained. So mm-hmm. it was just hands down, he won that.
The visual manner.
That visual thing. I would say one other thing. I just thought of something. When you talk about negativity, there may have been negativity that I did not see, but because there were no television ads or radio ads, that kind of nasty stuff couldn't be put up. Does that make sense?
Sure.
But there have been serious scandals that have affected French politics. So Dominique Strauss-Kahn, that's how François Hollande got elected. And then you have François Fillon, and that's really what elevated Emmanuel Macron into the position that he was in. The negativity has to do with the scandal, with the corruption. That was my outsider's take on that.
Shannon, do they do debates? Will you put 32 people on a stage for a debate down?
We haven't had a 32-person debate yet. I wouldn't be surprised if that eventually happens. I think the last debate we had maybe 10 or 12 of the presidential candidates, and it's very similar to the model here in the U.S. You know, very very quick. You only get 2 minutes. Really trying to give everybody an opportunity to answer the question, and at the end of the debate, you have no idea what you just watched.
Is it okay to interrupt during it? If you're answering a question, can I interrupt you during these debates, or is that frowned upon?
Sure, it's against the rules, but I mean, rules usually go out the window during those debates. I don't think they've gotten particularly vile, but yeah, you can interrupt, and you know, that's your chance to shine, because you really have to stand out, right? So you're going to say something outrageous, or you're going to say something funny, or you're going to say, you know, God wants me to be new president, something that will make voters remember you. So
after the debates, what's discussion like among voters?
I think that most of the time, the discussion is very similar to what I just said, this kind of inability to tell things apart and to figure out what each candidate stands for. A lot of the times, very similar to how the comment goes here in the U.S., you know, the sort of who won the debate, that's always a big question. But the conversation doesn't necessarily go towards a discussion of whether or not, you know, this debate made me feel more willing or less willing to vote for a certain candidate. So the debates are more of a show than an opportunity for candidates to discuss their platforms.
We're all shocked to hear that they're theater. That's you're killing us here with that sort of stuff.
Know.
Yeah. Outside of debate time, what is political discourse like? We'll just stay with Cheyenne for right now. What's political discourse like? If we go into a restaurant, if we go to into a coffee shop, what are we going to hear from people?
These are very interesting times in Brazilian politics. While on one side, there is a lot of division, there is a lot of polarization, there is a lot of hate, and I don't want to undermine that. I think it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous that, you know, right now, 28% of Brazilians intend to vote for an authoritarian pro-military candidate. So I don't want to downplay that. But at the same time, it's really inspiring and exciting to see people having these conversations. People don't usually talk about politics in Brazil in terms of substance. You know, it's all very abstract in the sense of politicians are corrupt or, you know, nothing works. Whereas now, because the stakes seem really high, there is a much more nuanced conversation around platforms. A lot of the times it's mostly saying you do not want to vote for a candidate X because candidate X is proposing these policies as opposed to saying this other candidate would do the opposite. But I think just the fact that people are feeling mobilized to talk and to act against specific policies as opposed to, you know, I don't like this candidate, I think that's something to be celebrated. So I'm trying to be an optimist here.
And that was Cheyenne Polamaju out in Washington, D.C. with New America. She is Deputy Director of Political Reform Program. Thank you very much for joining
us,
Cheyenne.
Thank you for having me.
Sitting at the end of the row here is Mike Wolf, a professor of political science here at Purdue University, Fort Wayne, also chair of the Department of Political Science. And then next to me, Julie Donnell, who spent what sounds like a wonderful time in France, but also a lecturer in French and in voice here at PFW. Thank you very much for joining us. I want to thank College TV for broadcasting this, as well as WBOI. And I want to thank the Departments of Political Science and the American Democracy Project for sponsoring it. Thank you very much for joining us.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to College TV for providing the audio for this program. Next week, we will bring you our October news roundup. In addition to taking a look back at stories from the month, we'll also have analysis of the midterm election results. Our music is by Mark Waldick. Folktales is next. Have a wonderful night.